Hello and welcome to Historical True Crime, the podcast where we take a look back at history's darkest crimes and criminals. I'm your host, Lizzie, and today is episode 76. In today's episode, we're delving into the murky world of one of the most notorious figures in medical history, Dr. John Bodkin Adams. Dr. Adams, a seemingly respectable physician practicing in the 1950s England, captured the public's attention like few others. But behind the facade of his esteemed profession lay a chilling reality of manipulation, greed, and suspicion. Adams's name became linked with scandal after he was accused of preying on his vulnerable patients. This led to a sensational trial that captivated the nation and will go down as a landmark in the archives of true crime history. Join us as we peel back the layers of deception, exploring the life and crimes of Dr. Adams. Throughout history, there have been instances where those entrusted with the care of the sick and vulnerable have betrayed that trust in the most egregious way imaginable. These individuals, often dubbed angels of death, wield their medical knowledge not as a tool for healing, but as a weapon for murder. Motives vary, ranging from a desire for power and control to financial gain or simply a twisted sense of mercy. There's numerous examples through history, including Nurse Jane Toppin, whose angelic appearance masked a chilling propensity for murder. Operating in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Toppin confused to poisoning at least 31 of her patients, though some estimates suggest the true number might be much higher. Her crimes were fueled by a twisted desire for control and manipulation, as she derived pleasure from watching her victims suffer. Toppin's case was shocking and served as a stark reminder of the dangers posed by those entrusted with the care of the sick and vulnerable. We've covered Jane on an earlier episode of this podcast. And in more recent history, we have the example of Dr. Michael Schwango, an American physician who earned the moniker Dr. Death due to his penchant for poisoning his patients and colleagues. His disturbing history of malpractice and suspicious deaths followed him from hospital to hospital, leaving a trail of devastation in his wake. Despite numerous red flags and suspicions surrounding his conduct, he managed to evade justice for years, before finally being convicted of multiple counts of poisoning and murder in 2000. But let's dive into the subject of today's podcast episode, John Adams. Adams was born into a devout Plymouth Brethren family in Randallstown, Ulster, Ireland, and spent his entire life as a member of this strict Protestant group. Samuel, his father, was a watchmaker by trade and a preacher in the community. He also instilled in John a strong love of automobiles. At the age of 39, Samuel wed Ellen Bodkin, who was 30 years old, in 1896. Their first son, John, was followed in 1903 by a brother, William Samuel. John's father would pass away in 1914 after a stroke, and the 1918 influenza pandemic would claim his brother's life only 4 years later. Adams, who had spent several years attending Coleraine Academical Institution, went to the Queen's University of Belfast at the age of 17. He missed a year of school due in part to a medical condition that was most likely caused by tuberculosis. He would graduate in 1921, but didn't have the marks to qualify for graduating with honors. Adams would receive an offer from a surgeon, Arthur Rendell Short, to work as an assistant houseman at the Bristol Royal Infirmary in 1921. Despite spending a year there, it wasn't really working out, and Adams would apply for a position as a general practitioner at a Christian practice in Eastbourne, Sussex, on Short's recommendation. Adams soon developed a thriving practice. He demonstrated a strong work ethic and solicitous nature, maybe going a bit too far, as he frequently made daily visits to the wealthier end of town, even when people weren't yet sick. According to Robbins' book, The Curious Habits of Dr. Adams, a 1950s murder mystery, by the mid-1930s, rumors about Adams' non-traditional techniques had begun to circulate. One example was Adams began injecting a Mrs. Agnes Pike with medications, including morphine, in 1939 or 1941. Mrs. Pike's condition worsened under his care to the point where the family phoned Philip Matthew, another physician, after learning of the situation from the owner of the guest house where Mrs. Pike was staying. Dr. Matthew proved that Mrs. Pike's treatment was unnecessary from a medical standpoint. Mrs. Pike was in such a state from her drugs, especially the morphine, that she couldn't even remember her age or her name. After being removed from Adam's care, she recovered nearly completely in only around 8 weeks, regaining her mental capacity and becoming well enough to go shopping on her own. It would be one uncommon instance of someone surviving under Adams' treatment. Adams would remain in Eastbourne throughout the duration of the war, earning a diploma in anesthesia in 1941. But he was known for being incompetent, while working one day a week in a nearby hospital. He would frequently eat cake, count money, fall asleep during surgeries, and even mix up the anesthetic gas tubes, causing patients to wake up or turn blue. But this didn't really seem to put a damper on his medical career. According to the Daily Mail, his transportation served as a barometer of his success. When he first arrived in Eastbourne, he was riding a bicycle. He progressed from a bicycle to a scooter, and then to an increasingly elaborate parade of automobiles, including Renault, Belsize, Humber 15, Hillman, and Austin, before arriving at a chauffeur-driven Rolls-Royce, which was the last remaining vehicle of a beloved patient who had died. This was his first Rolls-Royce, but it wouldn't be his last. In 1956, a highly drugged patient named Bobby Hewlett left him a Rolls-Royce Silver Dawn, valued at that point at £3,000. The more skeptical residents of Eastbourne did notice a pattern after a few years. Dr. Adams would seek out affluent patients, pay daily visits, administer strong medications, frequently for her nerves, offer to handle her financial matters, supervise a will modification, inject her with even stronger medications, and watch her slip into a coma before declaring her dead. Frequently, he would pocket a priceless item, such as a silver watch, gold pen, or costly camera, as a little reminder of the dear patient. Despite having checked the box on the cremation form indicating he didn't anticipate benefiting from her death, he would suddenly be named a beneficiary when her will was read aloud. Other strange instances included he once scheduled a postmortem before his patient had died. In a different scenario, he informed a nurse that his patient would only be a few minutes before she dies, despite the fact that she had merely been experiencing stomach pains prior to his injection. While Dr. Adams was sitting there reading a book, another nurse recalled a time coming into an old patient's bedroom in February and finding her freezing to death by an open window with her nightgown drawn up. According to the Daily Mail, one woman heard Dr. Adams begging her dying husband to give him all of his money and promised to make sure his widow was well provided for, as she happened to be walking by his bedroom door. This woman stormed into the bedroom, chasing the doctor downstairs. After that, she went back to the bedroom and asked her husband about any signatures he might have made. He couldn't quite remember what he had marked with an X. She gave her lawyers quick instructions not to accept anything that her husband had signed. She herself was sick in bed sometime after her husband died, when Dr. Adams paid an unexpected visit. He simply entered the bedroom without being asked or invited. She declared that she wanted nothing to do with him. He then noticed her husband's 22-carat gold pencil on the dressing table. He claimed to want something of her husband's and took it. Adams would then issue a bill for over £1,000 to her husband's executors. Eventually, overwhelming public outcry compelled the police to open an investigation. Things ultimately came to a head when Gertrude Hullett, 50, unexpectedly died on July 23, 1956. Leslie Henson, a music hall star, called to express her concerns. Adams claimed that Gertrude had experienced a cerebral hemorrhage. He had been treating her for depression since she had discussed ending her life following her husband's death. Gertrude included Adams in her will and offered him money to purchase the sports automobile her husband had promised to buy him. She was discovered in a coma the morning after Dr. Adams had given her several tablets. A sodium barbitone overdose had caused her death, and an inquiry concluded she had died by suicide. But police would open an investigation, and the list was narrowed down by police to 23 examples when Adams' patients passed away after they had included him in their wills. But Adams would be detained and accused of the murder of just one patient early in the morning of December 1956. He said to police, "Murder? Murder? Can you prove it was murder? I didn't think you could." Edith Morrell, an 81-year-old widow who passed away in 1950, would be the patient in question. On June 24, 1948, Morrell, a wealthy widow, had a stroke while in Cheshire visiting her son. She had partial paralysis and was taken to a hospital close to Chester, where Dr. Turner prescribed 9 days of morphine injections for her. After moving to Eastbourne on July 5, 1948, Mrs. Morrell was admitted as one of Adams' patients. On July 9th, he wrote a prescription for morphine, and on July 21st, he added heroin. Mrs. Morrell survived after her stroke for more than 2 years, despite being told she wouldn't live for more than 6 months. From July 1948 until August 1950, she would have regular evening injections of morphine and heroin. After that, the dosages increased as her condition worsened. Adams would receive a 19-year-old Rolls-Royce and a silver cutlery chest from Mrs. Morrell's son. Following her death, he also took an infrared lamp that she had purchased for herself. Adams would send bills to the Morrell's estate for 1,100 visits, but police estimate he only visited around 321 times during her treatment. Adams said on the cremation form that, as far as I'm aware, he had no financial stake in her death, negating the need for a postmortem. Now, Adams would go to trial in March of 1957, and it would be one of the most captivating and intricate court proceedings for that time period. The media referred to it again as the murder trial of the century, and one of the greatest murder trials of all time. At the time, the trial was the longest in British history, lasting 17 days. Adams would have been hung if he had been found guilty, but he's also renowned for never having testified in court, something that for that time period was simply unheard of. The volume of opiate medicines that Adams prescribed for Mrs. Morrell, his verbal admissions that he had injected nearly all of the prescribed dosages, and statements obtained from the nurses in August and November of 1956 served as the prosecution's three main arguments. According to nurses' statements, during the course of caring for Mrs. Morrell, Adams increased the frequency and dosage of injections. Additionally, many of the injections Adams administered contained medications that he personally prepared, rather than having the nurses do it. The nurses were also unaware of the contents of these injections. Leading defense attorney Lawrence would question Dr. Arthur Henry Dowaith of Harley Street, the prosecution's principal medical witness. Adams gave Mrs. Morrell morphine after she had a stroke, and he continued saying that, quote, "This could only have been prescribed with murderous intent." Lawrence would then pull up a file from Chester Hospital, the site of Mrs. Morrell's initial stroke, and noted that two different physicians had also written prescriptions for morphine there. Did they also have murderous intent? The British Medical Association dealt an early blow to the prosecution when it reminded all Eastbourne doctors in a letter to maintain patient confidentiality in the event that they were questioned by the authorities. A gap also existed between the legal and medical perspectives of how a terminally ill patient should be treated. It was acknowledged that the patient was given high dosages of morphine and heroin, but did this amount to murder? Or is it simply easing the passing of a dying patient? Defense attorney Lawrence would bring the prosecution's case to ruin. He persuaded the jury that there was insufficient evidence to support even the theory that Adams was the murderer. He emphasized that there were contradictions in the testimony provided by many witnesses, and that the accusation was mostly based on the statement of the nurses who cared for Mrs. Morrell. On the second day of trial, he produced the nurses' journals, which described how Adams had treated Mrs. Morrell. The prosecution claimed never to have seen these notebooks, but they differed from the nurses' recollection of events and showed that smaller quantities of drugs were given to the patient than the prosecution had originally thought based on Adams' prescriptions. Moreover, the two expert medical witnesses for the prosecution provided contrasting views. Michael Ashby was more reserved than Arthur Dowaite, who was more willing to declare that murder had unquestionably occurred. Medical expert and defense witness John Harmon was certain that, despite being uncommon, Adams' treatment was not careless. Lastly, by not inviting Adams to testify, the defense team caught the prosecution off guard and prevented Adams from chatting himself to the gallows. At the conclusion of the defense team's final address, Lawrence argued that Adams was innocent and that the prosecution's case was flawed. He said, quote, "Trying to ease the last hours of the dying is a doctor's duty, and it had been twisted and turned into an accusation for murder." The trial's presiding judge, Patrick Devlin, summarized the issues for the jury. First, the Crown must persuade you that she did not die of natural causes. Second, you must be persuaded that there was a killing. And third, if there was a killing, was it done with the intent to murder? After a lengthy trial, the jury took only 44 minutes to acquit Adams, and the prosecution would decide not to pursue any further murder charges since it was so demoralized by the outcome. Following the trial, Adams would leave the National Health Service. On July 26, 1957, Lewes Crown Court found Adams guilty of 8 counts of falsifying prescriptions, 4 counts of making false statements on cremation forms, and 3 offenses against the Dangerous Drug Acts of 1951. Adams would be fined £2,400 in addition to £457 in cost. On September 4th, the GMC terminated his license to prescribe dangerous medications, and on November 27th, they removed him from the medical register. But only 4 years later, Adams would be back on the job and allowed to administer dangerous medications once more. He would injure his hip in a fall of 1983 and pass away at the age of 87, leaving an estate worth more than £400,000. Though opinions on Adams has always been divided, the belief that he was a murderer has gained traction in recent years. Rodney Hallworth and Mark Williams came to the conclusion that Adams was a serial killer and most likely schizophrenic in 1983. According to the judge, Sir Patrick Devlin, in 1985, Adams could have been a mercenary mercy killer. Pamela Cullen, who speculates that Adam was acquitted more because of the way the case was presented than Dr. Adams' lack of guilt, requested that the police files be opened in 2003. She also draws attention to the fact that the investigation was hindered in terms of motive due to the lack of knowledge in the 1950s about what truly drove serial killers, that is, physical needs, emotions, and often bizarre interpretations of reality. The original investigators had assumed that financial gain was the motivation. Now, many have drawn comparisons between Harold Shipman and Dr. Adams, who both exploited the vulnerability of their patients for their own sinister ends. However, while Adams managed to evade justice, Harold Shipman's reign of terror eventually did come crashing down. In 2000, he would become the first doctor in British history to be successfully prosecuted for the murder of his patients. The meticulous investigation that followed uncovered a chilling pattern of deception and manipulation. Shipman's victims, mostly elderly women, were administered lethal doses of diamorphine, a powerful opioid under the guise of medical treatment. As the evidence mounted, the true extent of Shipman's crime became horrifyingly clear. His betrayal of the Hippocratic Oath, the sacred trust between doctor and patient, shook the foundations of the medical profession and shattered the lives of countless families. Over the course of his career, it's estimated he claimed the lives of at least 215 patients, though some believe the true number to be much higher. These weren't just numbers on a page. They were beloved mothers, fathers, grandparents, and friends, each with their own lives cut short by Shipman's callous disregard for human life. The public's opinion of healthcare providers has been profoundly and permanently impacted by the discovery of doctors and nurses committing these horrific crimes. The medical community has been compelled to face its shortcomings and implement important changes as a result of these crimes in order to stop things like this from ever happening again. The introduction of more stringent oversight and monitoring procedures within healthcare facilities has been one of the most significant developments. This entails tighter background checks on medical personnel, more watchful monitoring of medicine delivery, and improved channels for reporting questionable activity. Although still rare, cases of medical malpractice and murder still exist to this day. Now, Adam's case, while captivating and complex, ultimately did end in his acquittal, leaving lingering questions about his innocence or guilt. Despite this outcome, the suspicions surrounding Adam's actions and the evidence presented during the trial have led many to question whether justice was truly served. And with that, we've come to the end of another episode of Historical True Crime. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you did, please remember to review, rate, subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can follow us on social media, on Instagram at Historical True Crime Pod, or on Facebook at Historical True Crime Podcast. If you have any feedback or suggestion of something to cover on an upcoming episode, you can reach us by email at historicaltruecrimepod@gmail.com. And we'll see you next week for another dark and notorious case from history. We'll see you then.